Hey, welcome to this week's edition of the Terry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, your host, and I am joined by Mr. Terry Pluto. Terry, we have a lot to get into this week. The Guardians are red hot to start the season. The Cavs are not red hot as they head into the playoffs. And we can talk a little Browns. We've got some more really good foul ball stories. We've got a couple we can get into. But the big story of the week, I have to ask you, what did you think of the eclipse? Everybody's talking about it.
It was better than I thought.
Me too.
How's that? Because it was pretty overrated, it seemed like, for a while. But it was pretty cool. I mean, I had the funky glasses on. And it was neat. Even people I've run into today, the post office, and I go, you know, I didn't really know what it was. And I thought it was a neat. Now, I was ill yesterday, so I was not at the home opener, but I'm feeling fine today. But I talked to several people who were there, and they just thought it was such a cool kind of event along with the first game, and they played a great game too, 4-0.
Yeah, I was kind of in the same boat, Terry. Like, there's people who drive thousands or hundreds of miles to go see these things, and other people who are like, this is stupid, I don't really care about it. And I was kind of in the middle like you. Mm-hmm. But it was like everybody stopped. Like, with all the crazy stuff going into the world, and everybody's splintered into little, you know, they got their jobs and politics and all the crazy things. Like, everybody stopped and looked up at the sky for 3-4 minutes. And it's like we were all together for just that little period of time. And everybody went back to what they were doing. It was really cool and memorable.
Well, you know, from a spiritual point of view, it's like, you know, God coached that one his way. And you couldn't stop the eclipse. And this is what you get. And it comes whatever, every 40 years or whatnot. And it is remarkable to me is I was kind of watching a predicted like for 3:15 or whatever. And that's about when it went all dark.
It's amazing how they can do that so far out ahead of time. And I want,
but they can't tell if it's going to rain tomorrow for
that's
sure, Dave.
Right. Hey, I want to mention real quick, David Petkowitz, our colleague who's a photographer in the Cleveland.com Plain Dealer newsroom, brought 4 cameras, set them up right outside the terminal tower, and got the most incredible shot of the eclipse over the terminal tower. Check it out on Cleveland.com if you haven't seen it. And Dave also wrote a piece about how he got the shot, which I think is really interesting.
Wow.
He scouted this location out and had 4 cameras and really, really nailed it. It's an amazing picture, and you should check it out if you haven't seen it. So, all right.
You know what I like about it too, Dave? It says Cleveland.
Yep.
You know, because you could have gone, for example, over Lake Erie or somewhere and got a beautiful shot. But it could have been, because I think this thing went up towards Buffalo, kind of up upstate that way. You could have got it anywhere. But that says Cleveland with the terminal tower.
Yeah, if you want to search, his last name is Petkiewicz. And if you want to search on Google for his picture, it should come up on our website. So, all right, Terry, speaking of things streaking across the sky, the Cleveland – that was a terrible transition, sorry. The Guardians are 8-2. To start the season, they're 2 games up in the AL Central over Detroit. I don't think they've lost since our last podcast. I'd have to go back and look. But they have a plus 36 run differential, which is the best in the major leagues. And, man, going into the season, Terry, we thought run production was going to be a problem. And I know they're really focusing on run production over, like, home runs and stuff like that. It's all about run production. But you got to be surprised, right? Are you surprised by this?
I'm even more surprised by the bullpen. That was my big fear. I mean, these guys come firing out of there, everybody from Tyler Beebe to Kay Smith to Hunter Gaddis. I thought Gaddis would work out. I really did. I like that idea. He's the kind of guy that when he kind of struggles as a starter, you simplify it, you put him in there. If he could just throw strikes, he's going to do well. And that has been, I think, a key part of it too, because they talk about, well, they get out ahead and they win. Part of the reason they get out ahead, they win because the bullpen shutting them down, because you're only getting 4, 5, 6 innings out of these starters. And with Bieber out, they're going to have to even work more on that. But that's exciting. And then to see, I think a real kind of underrated part of this has been Jimenez is having a big year at the plate. And I didn't think he could play better second base than I've seen him ever play before, but he is.
Another great stop in the hole last night to throw somebody out. I forget who was at bat.
That he had a pop up where he went caught it over his shoulder. And remember, he's from Venezuela, and Omar is a big hero of his. And Omar would do that on those pop ups too. Be running out there, and you think he's not going to get it, just at the last second, little back it basket catch over his head, and he's got it.
All right. Well, do you want to spend a couple minutes on Jimenez while we're on the topic here? I can run through his stats real quick. You know, sure. It is early. He's batting 324. He's got an OPS of 936. His slugging percentage is 514. What are you seeing from him, Terry? Anything looking different to you in terms of the way he's approaching things at the plate, especially? But we know about the defense already.
He's looking more like he did in 22. That year he batted 297. The OPS was 837, 17 homers, 69 RBIs. Last year he got off to a miserable start and then just seemed to get in a lot of bad habits at the plate. And I wondered, is he just going to – he ended up hitting 250 last year. I wondered, will he just be a pretty decent hitter and a great fielder, or is he going to go back with a shot to be an all-star? And so when you have Kwan at the top of the lineup getting on, then you have against the right-handed pitching, you have Jimenez batting second, Jose third, Mayor fourth. That's a decent top of the order. That really is. And also you have some protection for Jose because you have guys getting on base in front of him, and you have Naylor behind him. And I'm just so excited because it's like even when the old tribe would be bad, I would say, get out to a good start. At least tease me for a while so that, you know, you could kind of get into it. And, you know, you could say they haven't played very good teams, but they're 8-2.
They are. Period. I was curious about Jimenez's start, and I was like, what's different? And I know you go to fangraphs.com a lot to look at stuff. And I thought this was interesting, uh-huh. Terry. His last season, he swung at 68% of pitches that were in the strike zone. And so far this year, he's swinging at 69% of pitches in the strike zone. So that's about the same. But they also track what percentage of pitches you swing at that are outside the zone. Last season, he swung at 39.8% of pitches that were outside the strike zone.
Ooh,
it
that,
is high.
That's
that was high. It tied his career high. And this season so far, he's only swinging at 26.5% of the pitches that are outside of the strike zone. So that's gone from 39.8 to 26.5. That's a lot of bad swings that he's not making this season. I wonder if that's something. It must be something they've talked to him about. But obviously, if you're swinging at less bad pitches and most of your swings are in pitches in the zone, that's a good thing, and it's showing up in his offensive numbers. So I thought that was interesting.
I tell you, I just wish the guys stopped getting pitches. I mean, you can laugh about it, but this is not. You know, this is not Albert Bell or somebody who, you know, when the ball hits on the ball screams and it doesn't, you know, he's a smaller guy. And I don't know why he just seems to just take such a pounding.
So he's leading the American League with five hit by pitches already, I think, right?
Five. They've played nine games or 10 games. And I think games. It was... at that rating, he gets hit 81
times.
It's
crazy. I think he led if not the majors, at least the American League in 2022. I think he had 25 hit by pitches in 2022, which led the league. And he's on pace, like you said, for 80. So
he hangs in there on those breaking balls mm-hmm. coming into him. You think by now he's just like, I would have a talk with him on that and say, you are so important in the field on the base. He's an excellent, excellent base runner. And you know, as part of this line, the go-go lineup here, if you keep getting smashed in your foot and your knee and your elbow, this is not going to fare well. And so get out of there. So anyway, but otherwise I think he's in the quiet part of what's going on here. And then he and Rocchio, I was talking to Andre Knott about a variety of things because I got a big interview with Andre, who's closer to Jose than anybody else in the media by far. But we were talking about the team in general, and he said the connection with Rocchio and Jimenez, you know, goes beyond the fact that they're younger middle infielders, the Venezuelan connection, and they both admire Omar. And that's very, very strong. And you could just see that they're really, they're really playing. By the way, now Roberta is now 2-for-2 on her prospects because a couple of years ago her guy was Rocchio. That came after Steve Kwan. Remember, these are guys who hadn't done a thing in the majors when she picks them out of a spring training game. One game is enough for her. I like that guy over there. I like that.
She needs to be a consultant, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm on Owen Miller and these other people never do anything.
Terry, I think that you might have stumbled onto a nickname for this team, the Go-Go Guardians. What do you think? I think you just said that, and I'm like, wow, that's a T-shirt. If they want to make one, that maybe we'll make that our headline of the podcast today. So, all right, hey, did you want? Go ahead, Terry.
And because the big thing too is, you know, they're still 29th in homers or whatever it is, but they're sixth in doubles, and the stolen bases, and I think they're fourth in infield hits. They were the Go-Go Guardians in 22, but we didn't know to call them that. That's back when they led the league in infield hits, and I think they were sixth or something in doubles, and you know they were 15th in runs scored. If you could be middle of the pack in runs scored, and your pitching holds up, you can win a ton of games, as they proved that. So last year it was just, you go back and look at that. There were a lot of things that were a disaster last year, and hopefully they're beyond that. Because some of these hitters now, Naylor, and you know, Josh Naylor is in the prime of his career. You know, Bo has a chance to get there. Jimenez is entering his prime, and Kwan now is not a kid anymore. And so you see that. And Tyler Freeman is time now. His batting average isn't very good the last I looked, but overall he's gotten some key hits for him, and I just kind of feel better about him at the plate than Miles Straw. And he's actually done a very, very nice job in center. So, and remember, they have the Lauder in the minors, and they have Manzardo. And those guys could be up in June, at least one of them.
So, yeah, I was just thinking about the old Gas House Gang of the Cardinals back in the 30s. They can be the Gas House Gang, and this team could be the Go-Go Guardians. So, anyway, I did want to, Terry, you've been working, you mentioned the column on Jose that you're working on. Do you want to talk about everything with the Guardians starts with Jose? I think, and same thing this season.
It does.
Why don't you talk about what you're writing about for tomorrow?
Well, the heart of that is, I just wondered, it's 2 years since he signed that contract. He signed it in the spring of 22, right before the opening day. Had he not signed a contract, he would have been traded. 99.9% sure of that, because they had a couple deals on the table. And in the end, Jose didn't want to go anywhere. He signed here. So I was talking to Andre about that. And I said, do you think he has any regrets or whatever? He goes, we haven't talked about it directly. He said, we've talked a lot about that. He goes, he still loves Cleveland. He said, the thing about Jose is, Jose doesn't care what other people think about his contract or where he plays or what. This is where he wanted to play. He said he's kind of like somebody from Northeast Ohio who's like, this is my home. I want to stay here. I could have gone somewhere else, but I don't want to. You know, I'm comfortable. I mean, really, Jose wants to play baseball and not be bothered. You know, whether he wants to do, you know, you want to interview him. I mean, if you notice you don't get a lot of interviews from Jose, he just doesn't feel like doing them. And so we're here. Like, fine, he's a superstar. I don't care. And that's part of the deal. Where if he had gone to New York or gone to somewhere else, he'd have to put up with all that other garbage. And that's what he thinks it is garbage. So, and I mentioned to you right as we were kind of there, you know, he's played in 152 games in six of the last 7 years. And the other year, he played in only 129, which is only still a lot of games. He plays all the time. He plays when he's hurt. He doesn't tell anybody about it. You know, we forget he came up as a second baseman. Then he moved to short. Then, and talk about this, in 2016, a lot of people forgot this, and I was looking up, he played left field for a while. Then he went back to second. Then finally he settled in at third. So it's the classic, you know, he's a baseball player. And then you look at, how does this guy steal 25 or 30 bases a year? He's not fast. He's smart. He is really, really smart. And he developed into a home run hitter without being a guy who piles up a ton of strikeouts. Andre's point is, he said, Jose has two goals. One is he wants to win a World Series in Cleveland because he knows what that would mean historically and if he could be a centerpiece of that. And the other, frankly, he said he wants to own like every Guardians record he could possibly get. You know, home runs, RBIs, you name it, he wants it. He wants to be the guy there. And Andre said he was talking to Lindor the last time the Guardians played the Mets. And you know, Lindor said, you know, Jose has become, you know, Cleveland baseball, and that they should build a statue to him. And he said, Jose would like that. He won't say that either, but he would like that. And if he plays another 4 or 5 years here and he piles up the numbers, they should build a statue
to
him.
No doubt about it. He's well on his way.
Yeah. And, you know, he wants to make the Hall of Fame, which is going to be tougher out of Cleveland. I mean, it's funny. I just saw a story. Oh, the other thing he said, I want to go in this direction, Dave. Who was the player that the Guardians acquired that Jose just about was ready to stand up and cheer and jump up and down about?
Oh, Austin Hedges? Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently, he was texting when he heard about that. You got to get him, because Hedges and Jose run the locker room. And if you watched Hedges yesterday with and we talked about this last week about McKenzie pitching, and I mentioned they should have Hedges catch him. Did you see how McKenzie was so much better throwing the Hedges? You know, he was throwing the ball low. Hedges, in fact, there was one play where Hedges, McKenzie, I think, was supposed to throw a breaking ball through a fastball. It almost took everybody's head off. And Hedges went out to the mound, and I really let him have it. And just that Hedges has a way, even though, you know, fans are hung up, but he hits 161 or whatever. The players don't care. They see the leadership. They see the defense. They see how much he cares. And they see how engaged he is in the game, whether he's playing or not. And you have, you know, the guy who is Mr. Cleveland Guardian, Mr. Cleveland Baseball, says, I need this guy to play the way you want your go-go Guardian style. Well, this is a guy that you need to make sure people stay on the go.
You're so right, Terry. When, you know, people who watch baseball are watching the pitcher to see what he's throwing and where the location is, but there are on every pitch, and even before, there are so many interactions between a catcher and a pitcher. Little, you know, gestures and setting things up and framing pitches and working the umpire, right? Like, if you get a guy like Hedges back there who does all of that beautifully, as a pitcher, you're just like, you know what? I'm going to listen to this guy. I'm going to do what he says. I'm going to throw the ball. And it makes things really simple, doesn't it?
And remember last year, we took a week. We said, Zunino can't catch anymore. Everything was bouncing by him. Turned out his hip was shot and everything else.
Along with his shoulder.
And they had a guy was Cam Johnson, whoever the heck the other guy
Cam
was.
Cam Gallagher,
you know, the only guy that could find it hit even worse than Hedges. And he wasn't very good back there either. And Bo Naylor was still learning. Well, now, you know, you have a real catcher they could put back there who's going to help defensively. That doesn't mean you want him playing five days a week, but you could spot him in there. And also, maybe with a pitcher struggling, I don't think it was a coincidence that Hedges got both of Bieber starts. I think they were trying to get Bieber going because also Bieber throws that sharp knuckle curve thing that bounces in front of the plate. See, Hedges tells those guys, don't worry about it. Just throw it right. I'll block it. Where if you're a pitcher and there's a guy on base and you don't trust your catcher, maybe you don't really snap off that curveball or slider like you want to because you're worried about it getting by him and the guy's running all over the bases.
Well, and looking down the road too, Terry, you've got Hedges, you've got Stephen Vogt, a former catcher, you've got Craig Albernage, you've got Sandy Allam. Like, Bo Naylor could not have asked for a better group to be around in 2024. I mean, he's going to learn so much. And I mean, who knows how long he's going to be catching, right? Like, if his offensive production is what they hope it'll be, they might move him to save the wear and tear. But for a young catcher, you can't ask for a better situation than being around these guys. So, all right, Terry, you wrote a column about Stephen Vogt that ran in today. We're taping this on Tuesday late afternoon. What are your impressions so far of Stephen Vogt and the way he is managing this team?
Well, it always helps when you have a really good bullpen. It makes the manager look smart. So that has been a big concern that I had early on was the bullpen because of all the injuries and the unknowns. And I also know if you get off to a bad start in a season with a bad bullpen, it really is a baseball virus that infects you all year. And it's been a while since the Guardians have had, last year the bullpen was way up and down, but I remember when they were really bad in the Tribe days, Sometimes it's like, oh, when Wedge was managing and this, it's like you didn't know what you were getting out of there. And it your team just doesn't have much confidence going into the late innings. So that has been an advantage for him. But also, clearly, the way they shaped it with Carl Willis and the other coaches, he's really been able to use it well. He talks about leaning on the other coaches, which is smart to do that and to talk about it. He clearly, when he talks to the media, I could see why this guy was probably a great interview for the Guardians, because he is very composed. He has a knack of talking about the obvious in an interesting way. That's very important for a manager or a coach. A lot of these guys forget that the fans, not just the media, but the fans are listening to all these interviews, and they're forming opinions not only just about you, but about things you're saying. I mean, this is an opportunity. Francona understood this, to sell his product. You know, talk about how good Stephen Kwan is, or talk about, like, he the other day went on this long soliloquy, I'm talking about vote, on David Fry, how he had to navigate. They had seven different pitchers in that game. You know, Fry sort of a novice catcher, and then he hit the three-run homer, and how Fry will play the outfield, he'll play first base. He's just a baseball player. And I think that fans like to hear that stuff and the enthusiasm in his voice. Now, he's new to it and everything else. But I have found that sort of guys either have it or don't. They either think that the way you communicate to the media and the fans is important, or it's like you're going to get a colonoscopy. I'm sorry. I mean, some of these guys just really look that this is so painful. And it doesn't have to be that way. Not in this market, that's for sure.
And you've seen this, Terry. There are coaches or managers who go into an interview after a game and they're just winging it, and whatever the media asks them, they'll talk about. I get the sense, and it doesn't surprise me with Stephen Vogt being a catcher and as analytically driven as this organization is, but he goes in with it's like a mental checklist of things that he wants to highlight. Like you said, if there's somebody he thinks hasn't gotten the right amount of praise or needs some support because they struggled, like it's like I can see him checking the boxes off in his head sometimes. Like he wanted to bring this up, that up, and that up to make sure that those were all out there, like you were saying, so the fans can get that message, which I think is really interesting. A lot of first time new managers don't approach it like that. They're just like riding the roller coaster with the media. So,
well, I remember this is another Eric Wedge story. Eric Wedge story time part two. I don't know where these are coming from. Well, it's Casey Blake was the last time, and you know about how sometimes you need to be very patient with a guy who's been up and down from the minors if you think he could play. Because anyway, so I forgot. I think I was just sitting there with Wedge or something, and before the game, and he said something or other, and he said, you know. I'll go out there at press conference. I said, you don't seem to enjoy the press conferences at all. And he said, well, you go out there, and the first thing is some stupid question to start. And I said, it's your press conference. Well, what do you mean? I said, you can go out there. I said, watch some of these football coaches, or they go out and they set up what they want to talk about. I said, you can do that. I said, you don't have to just wait for a question. You talk about it. It's your – basically, you're the maitre d', you're leading him to the table, you're handing him the menu. Now, you know, they could go in different directions, but you talk about what you want. And he said he'd think about it. He never did it, of course. It was almost like just being stubborn. And then we got into a thing about answering, because he said, well, what else do you think? I said, well, you know, you'll say like, well, Victor Martinez is a good hitter. I said, well, he goes, well, he is. I said, yes, but say why he's a good hitter. You know, you could talk about, I said, for example, Victor is a good hitter and he's a catcher, and catchers get all beat up and he's still a good hitter. I said, stuff like that. That's how you do. I said, the more you go and talk, you know, at some length, that doesn't mean make anything up. Just kind of come do it with a little enthusiasm. Of course, you never do that either, But the point is, I think that came naturally to Francona, and it comes naturally to Vogt. It's just natural to them. And I think a love of the game comes out that way when you talk about it, and fans want to hear that.
Good stuff, Terry. All right, hey, we have one more baseball thing to get into here before we move on. I wanted to get your thoughts. There is a rash of pitchers needing Tommy John surgery. Of course, most important to Guardians fans is Shane Bieber, who's going to be gone for the season. The list is long, Terry. Yuri Perez, Jonathan Loaisiga from the Yankees, Spencer Strider from the Braves. I'm trying to think if there's others out there. And there's kind of this debate that happened this week. The Players Association is blaming the pitch clock for these, what they are calling a rash of injuries. And MLB responded. I guess I could read the statements real quick to give people some background. Then I want to get your take on it. But the players said this: despite unanimous player opposition and significant concerns regarding health and safety, the commissioner's office reduced the length of the pitch clock last December, just one season removed from imposing the most significant rule change in decades. Since then, our concerns about the health impacts of reduced recovery time have only intensified. The league's unwillingness thus far to acknowledge or study the effects of these profound changes is an unprecedented threat to our game and its most valuable asset, the players. That was the Players Association statement. And MLB responded by saying that this statement from the players ignores the empirical evidence and much more significant long-term trend over multiple decades of velocity and spin increases that are highly correlated with arm injuries. Nobody wants to see pitchers get hurt in this game, which is why MLB is currently undergoing a significant comprehensive research study into the causes of this long-term increase, interviewing prominent medical experts across baseball, which to date has been consistent with an independent analysis by Johns Hopkins University that found no evidence to support that the introduction of the pitch clock has increased injuries. So MLB saying spin rates and velocity are causing the injuries, and the players are blaming the pitch clock, which has been shortened this year just by a little bit to 18 seconds with runners on base. It's the same as it was last year, other than that, which is 15 seconds with nobody on, and now 18 with runners on base. Terry, what do you think of all this?
Okay, the union's job is to press the players' interest. The players didn't like the pitch clock to begin with. The hitters like to stand out of the batter's box and fix every piece of clothing they have on between every pitch. The pitchers sometimes like to just wander around the mound, stare up at the sky, and look for seagulls. So that's the way it is. The fact is, the evidence does back up the owners. Fangraphs has a story up now. Fangraphs is an analytics site. And what they did, they cited a survey from Baseball Prospectus. And this is a number of pitchers that have been on a disabled list. So there's other things you could get in there. But in 2019, there were 192. In 2021, forget 20 because that was the
COVID year.
The COVID year. 21, 243. In 22, 236. And then the first year, last year of the pitch clock, 233. So in other words, it's been about the same the last 3 years going into this year. So there, the pitch clock has not been that big a deal. The league is correct, or the MLB, in terms of spin rates and fastball. 20 years ago, the average fastball was about slightly less than 92 miles an hour. You know what the average fastball is now in the big leagues?
93 and a half, 94?
94. And then they laid out all kinds of spin rates and everything else. Another thing, they talked about how the walk rate is going up. And why is that? Part of it is these guys are trying to throw so hard, break off such sharp curves, it creates more pitches. And they just tell everybody, just throw as hard as you can. And especially the spin rate. The spin rate is like how fast the ball spins. And if you're throwing sliders or curveballs, how do you make it spin faster? You snap it harder. And I really believe that's at the heart of it. And you roll all the way down into the high school ranks and everything else. Now, then the specialization, David, of everybody at these different camps, and they're all got their equipment there too. So you have younger arms being exposed to throwing harder and throwing with greater spin rates, because that's what everybody is there. And they're told, you know, I've got to throw 93. I got to throw 91 if I want a scholarship or if I want to get a pro contract. So it's why I think that's what the injuries are all about.
Pitching is a violent motion, man. Your arm goes through a lot of trauma every time you throw a baseball. That's some great research, Terry, and very interesting. And this isn't going to go away. Like, this is going to keep being in the news.
I mean, David, common sense is this. Why? Now, there's a lot of people, I like this argument too, that the specialization at younger ages where kids aren't playing different sports, it puts more strength in the arm or pressure on the arms, and that's correct. But why is it that you saw a lot more complete games and everything else, you know, 20, 30 years ago, a lot more than now? When these guys are better trained, they're bigger and stronger and better nutrition than ever. It's because they weren't being trained to exert so much effort on every single pitch. And none of that has anything to do with the pitch clock. I understand that sometimes pitchers may feel a bit rushed. I get that part. But now, if we had seen that in 2021, say there was 143 guys on the injured list, pitchers, instead of 243, and then this year there was 230, or last year 233, in other words, went up almost 100, I would say, yes, there's a big thing there having to do with the pitch clock. But the numbers, at least on that part, don't show it. Look at the story on Fangraphs of Beaver. It's got all kinds of data. I mean, your eyes will kind of roll out of your head.
It's what baseball fans like.
But it's all there.
It's weird, Terry. Like, I feel like, you know, like you said, 30 years ago, a pitcher would come in and they'd say, what do you throw? And you'd say, here's what I throw. Here's how I throw it. And they might say, all right, well, try this grip or maybe try this release. And it seems like now, I think you're onto something here. I think these pitching experts have tried to reverse engineer pitching, where it's like, this is what a great pitch should look like, and you need to change your delivery and your release to match what will create this spin rate and this velocity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be part of what's behind some of this. I don't have anything to prove it. I'm trying to think about what is different. And you know, Greg Maddux isn't everybody, but I mean, he came in, he threw the ball the way he threw it. He didn't throw it hard. He threw it in the right spots. He threw strikes, and he pitched for 20 years and he's in the Hall of Fame. And like, I'm just trying to think, if Greg Maddux came along today, would the scouts and the baseball people say, oh yeah, you know, your velocity isn't enough. You're not getting enough spin rates.
They'd mess with them.
To change everything you're doing to get it to where this is what a perfect slider should look like. And this is how you have to do it. I don't know. What do you think of that?
All right. Jarrett Wright story time. You ready?
Ready.
Okay. Wright had hurt his arm, and then he's trying to put his career back together. He goes to the Braves, and he goes down to the bullpen with Leo Mazzoni, who was one of the great pitching coaches at the time, with Tom Glavine and Maddux and a bunch of those other guys they had, Schmaltz and so on. So he says he's a size. He wants to show his health, and he's trying to throw, you know, real hard. He throws about 10, 12, just trying to get up to like 95 miles an hour with pitches or whatever. And Mazzoni goes, you really think that's working for you? How long do you think it'll be before you hurt your arm again, Jarrett? And he said, well, what do I do? So he has a catcher set up on the outside corner at the knees. He says, I want you to hit the glove. And he's trying to throw hard. He goes, no. Just throw a pitch right there and hit that glove. He says, and then what they taught with the Braves system is find a comfort level for your fastball that you could throw it on the outside corner at the knees. He says, whether you're throwing 97 or 92, they're not going to hit it anywhere there if you got a little movement on it and that. You know, then you move, you know, of course, you throw inside, you move off the plate. You need that pitch low and outside at the knees. Think about Maddux. Think about, of course, they end up moving that out a couple inches. But that was, it sounds so elementary. And he goes, if they hit it, fine. They hit a ground ball, whatever.
And live to fight another day, just, yeah.
It was completely different than what they do now. See, I remember I was talking to another executive, and I said, you guys are just obsessed with having pitchers strike out everybody. And he goes, Well, nothing could go wrong in a strikeout. He goes, other than maybe the catcher misses it, but that's it. That's correct if a pitcher is a robot. The problem, but even a robot sometimes needs servicing. And pitchers who are just aiming for strikeouts all the time are going to get hurt. And in the short term is the best way to pitch, but is it wise in the long term? Or was Leo Mazzoni and the Braves and a lot of those older guys on, let's find that comfort level on the low on the outside corner, and then let's come in at their knees and move them off the plate, you know, and then we'll go back out there again, and let's change speeds. Were they onto something?
Yeah, it's just a fascinating topic. I mean, there's been documentaries done about the knuckleball and all, like different ways to throw pitches. It's pitching is its own school with PhDs and everything. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see how things will change and what comes out of this, but really good research, Sherry. Thanks for digging all that up. And if you want to go to Fangraphs, you'll find some interesting stuff there if you're a baseball fan. So, all right, should we take a break?
I am all set. Go for it.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we get back, I'm going to ask Terry if it is time for Cavs fans to panic or not. So we'll get into that and more when we return on Terry's Talking. Hey, we're back on Terry's Talking. Let's get into the Cavs, Terry. Not a great road trip for the Cavs. They lost the last three games of this West Coast swing, and probably the most concerning, if you're a Cavs fan, was Sunday's loss to the Clippers. The Cavs were up big. I think it was 80-59 at halftime. The Cavs were moving the ball, playing great offense, and they end up losing that one 120-118. Luckily for them, they have Monday and Tuesday off today, and they're back at it tomorrow to kind of regroup, rest up, figure out what's next. But is it time for fans to panic about this team yet? Or are you feeling like they can still get it together in time for the playoffs next week?
Sure they can, but I'm very pessimistic all of a sudden. I've been upbeat because I don't see Mitchell coming back like Mitchell was before, unless something's going to happen. You know, medically, that's different. As I was watching him in a couple of games he did play, he would drive in and he would have layups and he wouldn't take them. He would end up throwing the ball way out or whatever. And I think part of it is not just the knee. I think it's the face. He doesn't want to get another broken nose. So that's, I'm not faulting. I'm just saying there's, you could look at tapes of him from January, February, all that, and then look at what started happening after March when he got hurt, and it's a different player. Meantime, he's such a heartbeat of the team that now the team is sputtering, and, you know, Garland has a good game, Garland has a bad game. He doesn't seem to just be able to really, you know, take it over. The identity that they had where the ball ran through Mitchell with all the player movement and that, it shows up now and then, but then it's just gone. And it's like they're unable to square around. And defensively, they've fallen apart. I don't have a good answer for that. And there are times when teams just stumble into the playoffs and they look like they're going nowhere and they find their mojo and they go and play well. I mean, one of the advantages of the playoffs is you don't play two games in a row. So that's why older teams tend to do better in the postseason because you could rest your veterans in between, and you don't have to play as many on the bench because you have more time in between games.
So, Terry, two things, Terry. Number one, so teams stumbling down the stretch, sometimes it can be they're worn out by the regular season. They're looking to the playoffs. They don't care. That's fixable. The other option is that the Cavs have some serious internal problems, and this is a sign of what we're going to see when the playoffs start. And right now, I think they'd be playing the Knicks if the season ended today. Do you think it's more of number one that they can't wait to get to the playoffs and they're sputtering and they're finding it hard to play motivated defense, et cetera? Or do you think it's the second one where this is what we're going to see?
I wish I could go in the first camp, but I'm more in the second one because of the fact Mitchell's not the whole deal, but Mitchell's a big deal. And I don't see Mitchell being anywhere close to what he was before. And Garland, you know, to be fair to him, with the broken jaw he had, sometimes he drives to the rim and there, and others, And see, with Garland, you can blitz him with a couple of guys, and he has trouble breaking the double teams. And so I don't know. I have to admit, because I was watching a lot of the women's games over the weekend, and then I blew it. All of a sudden, the Cavs were on Channel 43, which is great if you were paying attention to it. But when I was trying to DVR it, I was getting Bally Sports, and I don't know, I was watching some replay of some game from somewhere, and it's like, that's not what I wanted to watch. So I missed it, because a lot of what I do on a lot of these games is I tape them and watch them. I tend not to watch it live unless I'm, you know, covering that event that day.
Right.
And so I have to admit, I'm guessing more than talking from normally, because I kind of missed the last two games. The Laker game was bad. The Laker game was really bad. And the Phoenix game was awful. So I missed the Clipper game.
All right, so I'm going to put you in the GM's chair here for a second, Terry, and I guess JB's chair as well. But with, you know, Memphis tomorrow, three home games to wrap up the season. Memphis on Wednesday, Indiana Friday, and Charlotte Sunday. The Cavs have gone from third place to sixth in the East since our last podcast. They're only a
how
game
far
up.
Are they, yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah,
how far
they're
are they?
A game up on the Pacers, and they're only two games out of the play-in tournament.
That's what I wanted to know.
So
too.
What do you do? So there's two options here, I guess. Keep have Mitchell stumble along here and see if he can play, and or do you just shut him down until the playoffs? And you mentioned this during the playoffs, Terry. The playoffs are a marathon. There's a lot of off days. There's a lot of time between games. And in the nine games after the All-Star break, he's averaging 16.9 points a game. I think he's shooting like 37.8 from the field.
Awful.
And he's only playing 36 minutes a game. Like, what do you do this week if you're the Cavs? Sit him, shut him down, or try to keep this team from having to play in the play-in tournament and then get him some rest?
Well, I probably would rest him when they play Wednesday.
Yep, Wednesday night.
So he didn't play Sunday. So I would probably certainly rest him Wednesday and see if you could knock off Memphis, much like they knocked off Utah without him. And then that one might give me the option. If they do, then maybe you're in good shape with the play in and rest him one more, and then maybe come back and try and play him 20 minutes in the last game. They keep saying he's fine. He's not fine. Look at the tape. It's kind of like, remember, Baker Mayfield was fine. No, he's not. You know, look at the tape. And these guys, especially guys like Mitchell, played a long time, and even Baker, you know, they're not malingerers or anything. I mean, generally, this is one of the earliest lessons I learned as a sports writer on the pro level, is if a guy's played several years in whatever it is, in major leagues or the NBA, and suddenly, you know, there's a kind of an injury thing, and then he's back, and he's just not playing well, and it's going on for a while. He's hurt. That's all. The track record showed what he could do when he's reasonably healthy. He's hurt. And then it's a matter of what they can do. That's why, I have to admit, that's why the Bieber thing, it's like, I remember my lead is, he needs what in the story? Because it's like, what? He struck out 20 in 12 scoreless innings. It just was a stunner. I'm not, and again, I'm certainly not impugning him in any way. I mean, the MRI shows what it shows. But it's like, I don't know how he did that or how that happened. Whereas if they turned around and told us Mitchell has, you know, something else going on medically or whatever, would anybody be surprised? I mean, no. So that's... I don't know, David. Any thoughts? I'm at a loss.
I mean, I don't know what's going on with it, and I'm not looking at it every day, but I would shut him down until they need to play him.
Yeah.
And if they end up in the play-in tournament, like, so be it. Like, because if you don't have him healthy, it's not going to matter. So in the long term. Anyway, that's just my opinion. I'm not looking at his knee every day, but anyway, they'll have to figure that out. It's a very delicate situation because there's a lot at stake.
See, here's your challenge, too. They brought in Strus, and they brought in Niang, and now they've added Marcus Morris to add some toughness in that to that lineup, and Tristan Thompson. Now, maybe come playoff time, the defense and all that will improve because those guys will be on the court more. They will be locked in, and they will be able to help in that area. But then you go back, do you still have to score? I was so taken with the team from like the middle of December until Mitchell got hurt in March. I just love the movement, the scoring, taking three-pointers that were, for the most part, really smart three-pointers, and then keeping your defense still in the top five. That was a team that could do something in the playoffs, and then it just disappeared.
All right, Terry. Well, a week from now, when we do our pod, we will either be talking about maybe a playoff series with the Knicks in the first round or the play-in tournament. It could go a lot of different ways, so we shall see. But all right, real quick on the Browns, Terry. the president of the Packers today, Mary Kay Cabot, our colleague, has posted a story. He was speaking at an event and said, you know, we're excited. The Packers are the first or second most popular team in Brazil. And everybody thinks that could mean that he's letting the cat out of the bag a little bit in terms of the Packers going to Brazil to play the Eagles opening week instead of the Browns. I think it's best if the Browns don't go to Brazil. I think the fans would like to see them play there, maybe because it's something fun and different, but like this,
I don't think they do either.
Training camps, 18 weeks, 17 games. It's like, do you need to pile a trip to Brazil on top of that whole thing when you're trying to make a playoff run?
No, that's all. No. It's the same thing. Like, it's a little bit of a different, you don't have to travel, but the Hard Knocks. No, you don't want Hard Knocks in the middle of your training camp. You don't need all these cameras. You don't need all that. No, you know, simple is good.
I mean, there's a reason the Jacksonville Jaguars play in London like every year, like,
yeah, because nobody cares. Yeah. Whatever. I mean, that's not, you know, that. So good. Open in Jacksonville. I think the Browns are supposed to play at Jacksonville this year. Fine. Open the season in Jacksonville. Don't open the season in Sao Paulo. And there's nothing against Brazil other than it's in Brazil.
Yeah. You don't need more travel and all that. So, okay. Anyway.
And the fact is they haven't had an NFL game, where London, I guess, is not pretty good on how to handle these things. They've not had one there.
All right. Well, let's move on, Terry. I don't think there's much else to get into with the Browns, but I did want to talk about your faith column from the other day. The headline was, what to do when you're being sucked into family drama. And we all deal with this, and you had some thoughts on kind of how to negotiate the waters when that happens. So why don't you talk about that for a second?
First of all, when you start with families, you kind of have, in some cases, decades-long feuds. You have sibling rivalry. You have all kinds of things there going on. And generally in families, when, say, a fight breaks out between your brother and your sister, and you're in the middle of this, when they say, we want you to come in and kind of help, most of the time, they really don't want you to mediate the dispute. They want to get you on their side. That's usually what's going on. Now, once in a while, you can help that. But, I mean, even in my family, I've had to really learn how to say, look, you're on your own on this. Now, some people, and this is something, if you get hooked on or get hooked into this family drama thing, are you doing it because you take some sort of kind of twisted enjoyment in it, you know, being part of the drama and or being felt I am needed? Now, there are times if you have some cachet with the family when having people sit down and try to talk things through, you can do that. But I think after a while, you will find out when it hasn't worked a few times, all it's going to do is cause you to have ulcers. And then as I talked to a Reverend Anthony Parker, he's an interesting guy because he's got Rhema Church in downtown Cleveland, but his main job is he is a bailiff in Cleveland County Police Court. And on the side, he must want a lot of jobs. He's a magistrate in
North Randall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, especially with family court, he just listens to this stuff all the time. And he said, even my own life, a couple of times I got involved in it. And you know what happened? Both of them turned on me. It's like, you know, well, you're the one that actually, I'm like, wait a minute, you asked me to come in.
Yeah,
here.
He said this. So, he said that. You won't believe what he said.
So I guess what I'm saying is, be very careful in these situations, because oftentimes, as he said, you'll get this call at midnight or whatever, and you know, you have no idea what Dad just said, and it's driving me nuts or what. And then you think you got to get in the morning, and if you just wait a day or two, most of the time, it just goes away. It's petty. Now this is not about, you know, somebody is abusing somebody else physically, or, you know, this is like just regular family mess. And there's enough of that to go around. Now, when there's serious situations, that's a whole other deal. You know, do we have to intervene and get him into drug rehab, or what should we do about this? You know, that kind of, that's different. But I really think that there's a temptation to want to, some of us just want everybody to play nice in families, and they're not going to do that no matter how much we want it.
Yeah, and I thought Anthony Parker made a really good point. Sometimes people call not because they want help solving the problem, but as he said, they want you to tell them they're right. Like, they're not trying to solve the issue. They just want confirmation that their side is the correct one. And that's something correct to keep in mind. So,
and then if they bring you in, they may say, I want you to come in and help us fix this or whatever, but they really think that you'll join them and beating up on the other party.
All right, well, check out Terry's Faith in You column every week, but this one we're just talking about was on cleveland.com last weekend. You can find it at, along with all of Terry's stuff, at cleveland.com/Pluto. So check it out.
You could actually, you know, if you Google Terry Pluto Faith in You, a bunch of them pop right up.
Nice. There you go. You can read them all. And don't forget about Terry's book, The Guy with the Sign, which is available at terrypluto.com. You can find it there. So, all right, Terry, let's see. I need to do a quick plug for our new Dine, Drink, Klee podcast that our newsroom has started. If you know anything about the food coverage that our entertainment and culture team does, we've got some great people covering it. Josh Duke and Alex Darris are hosting this new podcast, Dine, Drink, CLE. They'll give you the latest about what's going on with foodie happenings. They'll talk to experts, including Mark Bona, who covers the heck out of beer for us. He knows everything about the beer industry in town, the microbrewing. Paris Wolf is on there, Pete Shakarian. Check it out. Dine, Drink, CLE, and you can find it anywhere where you find your favorite podcast. So, all right, Terry, we do have some more foul ball stories. They are coming in by the dozens, and they are going to last us all season, I think, because there are some great ones, and we want to get to all of them. So you ready for today's? Let's sure do it. This one comes from, I have to scroll down to the bottom. It's Bob Morey from Bay Village. And Bob has a story. He says, back in the early 90s, I worked for the YMCA of Greater Cleveland. Every once in a while, tickets for Indians games would find their way to our branch from the corporate office. On this particular day, the Red Sox were in town to face the Tribe. Cleveland wasn't a very good team back then, and the crowds were sparse. Our corporate tickets were very nice, right behind the first base dugout. I was about 24 years old and had attended my fair amount of games in my lifetime without ever coming close to snatching a foul ball. Chris James was the batter for Cleveland. It's funny. Everybody remembers who was at bat. I love that. Chris James was the batter for Cleveland, a decent player with good hustle. I was seated among 6 to 10 other YMCA employees who also took advantage of the tickets. Seated next to me was my future wife, who disliked baseball, but fortunately liked me enough to tag along. A co-worker named Donna sat to my other side. James was in the batter's box. I don't remember what inning it was or the score, but I do remember that Donna had left her seat. James took a nice rip at a pitch and sent a towering foul pop in our direction way, way up in the sky. I like to think that having played baseball for many years leading up to the historic moment in my life gave me an edge on judging the trajectory of the baseball as it hung in the sky forever, but I think it was just plain luck with possibly a sprinkling of love for my dad who had passed away a couple of years earlier. Whatever it was, I absolutely knew that baseball was coming to me. Everyone around me in our section stood up as the ball began to descend towards us, except for my girlfriend, who had taken a fetal position at this time. I stood.
She probably thought you had bad that's hands. Right.
I stood and tracked the angle of the ball with my eyes. With using incomparable total focus and concentration, I extended my right arm upward in anticipation of the snag. I don't remember anyone around me jockeying for position. In a brief but lifetime-defining moment, I'll be darned if that ball didn't land smack down in the palm of my right hand. No bobble, No double clutching, no hot potato, just a pure, clean snag. Of course, the ball plummeting into my bare hand at an accelerated rate made for a pretty loud impact, but the momentary pain that shot through my arm was nothing compared to the lifelong warm memory that it's given me for 30-plus years. That baseball sat in my shelf in my room for a long time. I glance at it from time to time and remember the scenario vividly. As the years passed by, the ball was put in boxes and drawers and closets. My son Matthew is a diehard Cleveland sports fan. And one particular afternoon, he and I had the opportunity to attend an event featuring current and past Cleveland players. I wanted Matt to get some autographs to commemorate the occasion. Not having an MLB-certified baseball laying around the house or a ball displayed in a collection, it was then that I remembered my Chris James foul ball. I dug through some boxes and located it. It looked a bit worn, but like any vintage item, it had character. We took the ball to the event, and a couple of hours later, it was filled with signatures from some great Indians players. The ball gained a second life, so to speak. Matt was thrilled with his new keepsake, and years later, I'm happy to say that he still has that ball in his very own collection. That single baseball has allowed both my son and I to share a lifelong memory that is dear to us both individually and together. I'm so glad I went to that game. Thank you, Chris James. That's a lovely letter, Bob. Thanks. Again, that's Bob Morey from Bay Village.
What record does Chris James have?
Oh, boy. It's something like, did he hit 3 home runs in a game? What did he do?
9 RBIs in a game. 9 in 1991.
So that's a good stat.
Well, yeah. He probably drove in 10 that year, but he had 9 at one day. I don't know. No, he was okay. All right,
we got one more, and this one comes from Mark Civic from Savannah, Georgia. He says, hey, guys, this is Mark, your correspondent from Savannah, Georgia. Foul balls must be allergic to me. As a lifelong Guardians Indians fan for more than 50 years, I have managed, despite being a partial season ticket holder, to catch one foul ball my whole life. That one time, however, was memorable. The Friday before Game 7 of the 2016 NBA Finals, my wife and I were at the Indians game. As I recall, it was a beautiful day, and in the first inning, a foul ball comes right to me. As I grabbed it, I turned to Lori, my wife, and said, it's a sign. The Cavs are going to win Game 7. 2 days later, I clutched that foul ball the entire Cavs-Warriors game, and my good luck charm paid off. I should add that Lori and I got engaged at a Cavs game on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1990, and the 2016 Finals coincided with our 25th wedding anniversary. In fact, Game 3 of the 2016 Finals occurred on our actual anniversary, June 8th. Of course, we attended that game along with our two adult children, Missy and Max. Years later, I can't find my lucky ball, but that's okay. That lucky ball had served its purpose. Maybe there's another foul ball coming my way. When it does, let's hope we are on the eve of a championship for one of our hometown teams. Keep up the great work. And again, that's from Mark Civic in Savannah. Thanks for that, Mark.
There you go.
That's it for foul balls. Keep sending those to us, and we will keep reading them. It's a long baseball season, and these have just been gems, to use a baseball term. Really fun to read. You can send those to us at sports@cleveland.com, and we'll keep trying to get them on. So, good stuff. All right. I think that's all for today, Terry. You got anything else you want to get into? A book? Anything you've been reading or seeing? Or
nope. I think that's
it's all
it.
Been basketball for us.
Of all the podcasts we've ever done, what is this?
This
one,
is
David?
The most recent.
Thank you, Les Levine.
Indeed. All right, we're going to let you go. We'll catch you next week. Don't forget about Terry's newsletter. You can sign up for it and get the best of Terry every week, every Monday. Go to cleveland.com/newsletters and just click on the box. It takes like a minute. That'll do it for us. We will catch you next time on Terry's Talkin'.